COVID-19 has demonstrated to me that the real estate agents that understand the four parts of a real estate transaction, understand it and live it, will always survive in any marketplace that's thrown at them.
You're listening to Elevate, the official podcast of Elite Agent for Real Estate Industry Sales Professionals, Property Managers and Leaders. With thanks to our partner, Connect Now, Elevate brings you the best tools, thinking and strategies to elevate your results. To download your written action guide from this podcast, containing extra tips, links and shortcuts, visit EliteAgentElevate.com. And for more information about how Connect Now can make moving easier on your clients, visit connectnow.com.au. Here is your host, Samantha McLean.
Welcome to another episode of the Elevate Podcast, where we delve into some of the most interesting minds in business and in real estate for the very best tips and strategies for you to implement to elevate your business. I'm Samantha McLean, editor of Elite Agent and host of this week's show. Joining me today is the chairman and owner of Century 21 Australia and Better Homes and Gardens Real Estate Australia. Welcome to the show, Charles Tarby.
Thank you, Samantha. What a great introduction.
Thank you for joining us today. It's great to see you again. It's been a while.
It has been a while. Everybody's been busy and in their own way and coping with the changes that have gone on. Some of those changes have really brought the industry back to an operating level of back to basics. It's been quite interesting watching how real estate agents are demonstrating property, you know, whereas a one-on-one, and we had to do that for a while, and I think back in Victoria now we probably still have to, and, you know, no more of that flurry of open homes where you just open up the house and people come bursting through. Yeah, you know, you've got to have that social distancing, and it gives you a chance now to do what you were supposed to do in the first place, and that's take people's details and communicate with people and show them the property and find out what they're thinking, get some feedback, correct feedback, utilize that feedback to further advance your sales process. And in further advancing your sales process, it gives you an opportunity to close a transaction and then start the negotiating process with your seller and your buyer and making sure that they both walk away feeling as though they achieved what they wanted to achieve. Those are the sorts of things that disappeared, particularly they disappeared very quickly during a boom where all of a sudden everybody's just running around almost in a process of order taking. And it's funny how so many people leave the industry once that order taking process leaves us. So COVID-19 has demonstrated to me that the real estate agents that understand the four parts of a real estate transaction, understand it and live it, will always survive in any marketplace that's thrown at them.
Before we get on to some of the other stuff that I want to talk to you about today, can you outline what the four parts of the transaction are for people that might not know you so well?
Yeah, look, we focused on this for a very, very long time. You know, back in the 70s when I was a real estate practitioner, a real estate agent, real estate salesman, I call it practitioner, but we weren't recognized that highly at the time. I think we're doing a little bit better now. For me, it was always about when I got a chance to sit in front of somebody, when I got a chance to get the business, that prospecting component of that business was the big, big part for me. And so that marketing aspect of yourself or that creative mechanism that we use to get ourselves in front of sellers was the hardest part. And I was an independent real estate agent. So whenever I got in front of somebody, it was because I either door knocked or sought out a referral from a client I might have sold to afterwards and asked them the question, do you know of anybody else, etc. And asking sellers a fantastic prospecting question, which is, do you know what else is happening in your street? Because quite often they wouldn't tell you because they thought you already knew and they didn't want to look stupid. And asking that simple question, people would often say to me, oh, you know, I thought you knew such and such and such and such. And so that component of it is really the critical part, is that creation of activity, capturing that data, cleansing that data, which gave me the opportunity to convert that data. So for me, that first process was learning how to prospect effectively and not relying on a marketplace or a changing marketplace that would give me my leads or expecting my principal or the business itself to generate leads for me. That component is a critical part. Very, very poorly used in most parts of the industry. Agents are told nowadays, get on the phone and call 100 people a day. Well, you know, I did that and I got out and door knocked every day with my team. And, you know, you get told until you learn how to do it to get lost. 98 times out of 100, which is very demotivating. And what was disappointing, I think, for most people who lived in certain areas was that those people that had a name that started with XYZ, they never got a call because most agents never got past ABC. And so there you go. There's the first sign of discrimination in this industry. We just did not call those people. So for me, that component was really, really important. And we've created some mechanisms to make that easier for our agents now. They shouldn't have it as hard as my team and I had to have it in those days where you knocked on doors, people told you to keep your religion to yourself, or if you're walking past a house and they were hosing their garden, they'd hose you. dogs would chase you. Sometimes they'd catch you. And that was what it was like. But nowadays, we've developed mechanisms to create opportunity, and we call it the opportunity score in our organization. So if somebody comes into an open home and registers on our platform, our electronic platform, if they request a contract or a building report or a plan or whatever the agent's loaded into the back end of the listing, every time they select something, it scores them. When they get to 47 points, they hit the desktop, meaning that their activity levels are so high that it's now time for the agent to give them a call because they realistically want to hear from the agent. And so that to me is the first pillar. It's that creative mechanism. It's making sure that you're generating leads. It's making sure that when you capture that data, you cleanse that data and you utilize the processes you have or the platforms you have, or even if you don't have any software, just get on the phone and start talking to these people. So that's the first part, Sam. The second part was the presentation. So it's the prospecting and then the presentation. And that was critical for me. In those days, I used to cut pictures out of the magazines, they were black and white pictures, and I'd file them in suburban price order. And when people would call and say, I'm thinking about selling my home, I would pull these little bits of paper out, stick them onto a blank page, and then I'd put a little report at the front, which was about as basic as you could get from microfiche stuff at the council. And then I'd trundle over to their home with an appointment, and I would start my presentation. And to me, that's where most agents fail. When I wrote the book Listing Rich, my second book, I did it incognito in some areas. I can't tell you some of the things I did to get data, but I can tell you that I sat in a friend's home when they were thinking of selling in an area where we didn't have an office. And I said, look, let me just sit here as a friend and listen. And the first agent came in, and within seconds they were boasting about how successful they were and the fact that they don't do auctions because auctions don't work. And the following agent that came in said, boasting about themselves, that our success is because all we do is auctions. And I started to realize that the consumers don't bag our industry. We bag our own industry by saying, I do this and I wouldn't do that. And the other agent comes in and says, I do this, but I wouldn't do that. And so the presentation component became a critical part. And so we developed progressively color palettes that we would take out, and it got better and better and better. And now it's all electronic and people get gifts and there's market strategies. But still, it comes down to the agent, the agent's ability at that presentation, because if they do get the listing and they don't educate the seller, they're now in trouble. So part of the presentation was the education of the seller. Some sellers aren't as educated as others. And for us, there are 11 parts of an education process where, from my experience and my team's experience, up to 11 things can go wrong when you take a listing. And if you don't educate your seller about those 11 things, if one or two of them occur, they're going to blame you. And the whole concept of real estate is that we are a third party. We're not the buyer or the seller. We're the third party. So we need to start acting like the third party, and we need to set the stage and say, hey, it wasn't me. We went through this. It was either you or the marketing, and here's the strategy that we went through. So that presentation part is key, okay? Then there comes the part of presentation of the property. So you've got your prospecting, you've got your presentation, then you've got your property presentation. That's, again, a massive area where things go wrong. And you've seen it yourself where real estate agents have a for sale sign out the front of a property with a big photograph of themselves in there. And I fight with some of my team on this. What are you selling, yourself or the property? Because you need to have a photograph of what's inside the property. I've seen some signs where they've got a photograph of the home and it's outside of a property. So, you know, a lot of things go wrong in that arena. And obviously we make those same mistakes as an organization around the traps. And we're constantly trying to sort that out. But presenting a property for sale, and here's where COVID has come in, demonstrating a property effectively has been lost in our industry. It's gone. And COVID proved that. It proved that a lot of agents had no concept of how to present a property. We would walk into a property and we would guide people through a property. If you don't guide them, they walk in the front door. If they see something pretty in the garden, they go straight out into the garden. And now you've got people everywhere around the home. You've got kids checking a trampoline out. You've got the father checking out the garage. You've got the mother checking out the kitchen. And that probably sounds a little sexist, but you know what I'm getting at. And now, who's presenting the property? Where's the agent in doing their job? You're supposed to be demonstrating a property to a family to find out what their feedback is and take that feedback and work with them until you isolate every objection that they might have about that property. And that's when an agent's doing their best work, is in demonstrating a property. And that seems to have disappeared. But COVID has also shown that we need to understand how to demonstrate property. So from our perspective, that's been, again, a critical part of it. And we're developing presentations for those first three things that I've spoken about, so that if I can get to this level where a person at a high concierge level, not a salesperson, at a high concierge level can do that prospecting because people want to talk to them, go and present what the company's all about and do it visually as well, be able to demonstrate that property, and now the final part of it, closing the transaction. And for me, closing the transaction needs to be transparent, and it's not in our industry. One platform, and I give it a plug, I want to say that I have an interest in this business, is open negotiation, which is not auction, not private treaty. It is somewhat of a hybrid of both, but it stands on its own, meaning that the buyer and seller are negotiating when the agent is still sitting there as the third party. It's not the agent going to a vendor and say, I have an offer. And the vendor says, I want more than that. So they go, okay. So they run back to the buyer and say, oh, the vendor wants more. Okay, offer on this. And off they go. And sometimes that process is not very transparent at all. So for me, they are the four pillars of real estate: that prospecting, the presenting to the vendor, presenting the property to the buyer, and negotiating that transaction. And I have to say that negotiating a transaction has taken a real backseat when the boom comes on, because an auctioneer stands up in front of a property, screams out numbers, and people throw money at the auctioneer until they run out of money. The auctioneer bangs a hammer down and everybody's excited. There's no negotiating in that. That's just a process. And so that has been what's happening. Now that you're in this position we're in right now, a lot of agents have left the industry. And those that know how to negotiate and work with a buyer and seller to establish a level where they're both happy, that's a skill that real estate agents, in my belief, still need this day and will need beyond COVID-19.
I agree with you. And it's interesting what you were saying about presenting the properties, because you just made me think for a moment about if an agent is presenting a family home to a family, you need to be everywhere and understanding what mum wants, what dad wants, what the kids want. And that's no easy task.
It's not, Sam. And in the good old days, we would qualify people. And agents can still do that. And it's very simple. If somebody, you know, rings you up or turns up at your open home, you could have a 3-minute conversation with people. You know, it's like, what do you have now? What do you like most about? What would you alter, improve? Who are the self make final decision? How much time do you have looked at that? Blah, 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 bang. They're really simple questions. And you would ask people because they tell you. I remember myself and a young guy when we were young real estate agents, we tested things out. And one of the things was that we'd walk up to somebody when they came into our exhibition home and say, would you like a brochure? And 9 times out of 10, they'd say no, because they felt confronted. It's like when you walk into a shop, people say to you, can I help you? You went in there for something, and half the time you say, no, thanks, I'm just looking. And then you're standing around going, where's the bloody customer service? And so we decided, instead of asking people if they want a brochure, we would just walk over to them and push the brochure into their hand. And I'd start walking away, and I'd say, look, my name's Charles, here's a brochure of the property we're in. And they'd grab it, because when you push something in somebody's tummy, they grab it, and I go, if you have any questions, I'm just over here. And look, they would automatically say, oh, Charles, is this a 3-bedroom or a 4? And so the conversation would start. And I was now qualifying these people, just simple questions. That seems to have disappeared. We're playing a numbers game. Get as many people through the open home. You see it on social media every day. I had 17 people through my open home. And I think to myself, I've gone to open homes. They ask me for my details. I give them the details and never call me back. And so what's so great about having numbers through? We had a situation years ago where we put people on stage We used to have awards nights and training events, et cetera, then. It was a very big thing. And I remember putting an office on stage because in stage of 4 weeks in a month, they achieved 423 registered buyer inquiries. We used to register them on hard copy on our inquiry sheets. And they achieved 37 exclusive agencies with four salespeople because we never took open listings in my company. That was the rule. And that was an amazing event. And we stood them up on stage and we gave them a standing ovation. And I won't tell you who the person was because you'll know this person. And we gave them a standing ovation for that achievement. But something didn't sit right for me. The transactions they were doing didn't seem to match those numbers. Now, we were a flat fee franchise, so it wasn't about dollars. So people reported what they were doing. I tracked those names for 6 months. Anytime something happened with that name, I would put it in my little list. And at the end of 6 months, you're going to love this, 2.7% of those 423 people made it onto a transaction, 2.7%. So 97.3%, if my calculations are right, were basically put up against a wall and shot. Of those 37 exclusive agencies, 24.6% had sold stickers on them after 6 months. Now, for me, the for sale sign is a sign of success. After 4 weeks without a sold sticker, it's a sign of your failure to achieve a result. And anybody who lives in that area is not going to call you because you're not getting a result. And when people say to me, how do you choose an agent? I said, it's really simple. You go into an area, you do not choose the agent with the most number of for sale signs, because if you give them your property, you are now in competition with a whole bunch of people that agent has. You go to the people that have sold stickers on their property and you knock on the door, and if they own that property, you ask them what the agent was like. That, to me, is the best way. So those numbers proved to me years and years and years ago that it is not about that. And so we developed the strategy that we call, and I struggle every time to get this into the minds of a lot of people, that we are not an activity-driven business. We don't want to be an activity-driven business. We want to be a performance-based business. Hence the reason I spoke about opportunity score, so that when somebody comes into open for inspection, they're connected to us. When we send them a broadcast, an EDM from our system, and they open it up, they get scored. If they share it with a friend, they get scored. Every time they open it up again, they get scored. Each time they do that, they push themselves up into a platform that says, hey, call me. You don't have to go into a Century 21 or a Better Homes and Gardens office and start calling cold leads. They are there on the desktop every morning. And that's the key for me. That was the big change for me. And how that happened, I just woke up one morning, I thought, how simple can it be? If we just keep the activity of people in mind, and once they come to us, we keep connecting with them, then why don't we just consolidate that data in real time, and it gives us what an agent might call a hot lead. There's no need to categorize leads anymore if you're operating in your system effectively.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of doing it. In fact, it's pretty similar to the way that we do it with our engagement scores for people that read the brief. And a lot of systems will do that today. But it's interesting that you're talking about not playing the numbers game while using the numbers wisely.
But you've got to capture the data first, Sam.
Yeah.
And then you've got to cleanse the data. And that's where the majority of our industry fails. In terms of creating activity, it's pretty easy. I can take somebody down the best street in their suburb where the average price of a property might be $800,000, and we can put a flyer in the mailbox saying, I've got a buyer for a home in this area up to $1.2 million, and everybody will call you. So that sort of activity is not necessarily good activity. But if you can capture that data and then cleanse it, you know that you've gone down three processes with people. And if you don't do that, you're going to end up with a database with thousands and thousands of people who really, really couldn't give two hoots about you. But you sit there at the office and go, well, I've got 12,000 people on my database. Well, you so what? It's like I said to you earlier, I've been in real estate nearly 50 years. And some people could say, well, that's 1 year 50 times, which means I've made no progress at all. I hope they don't say that, of course, Sam. But nonetheless, it's the same with data. You know, I've got 8,000 or 10,000. Well, so what? You know, how clean is it? If I send out a broadcast to your data, which we can do, and the analytics come back on our system immediately as people start looking at that EDM, sometimes you look at it and you can see only 23% of the people have engaged. And you think, well, what happened to the other 70%+? Guess what? They're not interested. They don't care. Your database isn't that great. So the numbers game is fine, but if you don't cleanse that data, then you're just wasting a lot of your time.
Yeah. I remember one of my first interviews with you, I called it face-to-face, one-to-one, and you introduced me to the term belly-to-belly.
That's correct. Yeah.
That was the first time I'd heard of that. And these days, well, you can't really get belly-to-belly with people because of COVID, and nobody really wants to see anything paper anymore. Like if you handed someone a brochure, they'd probably go, ooh, where's that been?
Correct. Yeah, correct.
So what sort of things are you telling your franchisees at the moment to replace those things that we all know and love?
Look, it is still face-to-face, belly-to-belly, contact-to-contact. It is, because you can do a Zoom meeting with your seller now and you can sit there. And in fact, I think the Zoom meeting is far better, because most agents say to their sellers, I'll be in touch with you regularly. And they don't, because if they don't have anything to say, they'll often not even call their seller. But if you set up a Zoom meeting and say with your sellers, I'll be face-to-face with you every week and we can talk about what's going on. Now, obviously, EDMs have replaced the usual handout brochure that we do. What we try to do when people come into an open for inspection is if they can either populate an iPad at the front door or the agent populates it. So the process has started, and that begins at contact-to-contact. And the Zoom is face-to-face and also, I guess, belly-to-belly. But my main thing there is voice-to-voice. Those other three are great, but if you don't speak to people, if you expect an EDM to do the job for you, or you expect the flyers out in your there with the signs or to do the job, that's where you're going to be an average real estate agent. To me, it's what we're doing right now. If I pick up the phone, I can get more out of a conversation with somebody. In fact, I went to an office one day that was saying, oh, it's not working, this is not working, blah, blah. And service team said to me, look, we're not getting a result here. And they're sort of getting a bit aggressive with us. I said, look, I've known them for years. I called and said, hey, I'm coming out to do your meeting. And it was like, oh, you're coming out. Yes, I'm coming out. And I had a quick look at what we call a desktop analysis. Because we are a real-time organization, I can look at into any office's performance and stats from either my phone or my desk, and so can they. And it gives me a view around their business pipeline, around their op score, and around their broadcasting platforms and so on. And I did a desktop analysis, as we call it. So I was very well armed when I got to the office. And I sat in the boss's chair, which I kicked him out of his chair. And as he walked past me, he was about 6'4". I could sense he wanted to snot me, you know. Anyway, I sat in his chair and I opened up their system and I went to the business pipeline and I said, look at all these P's here. The P's mean prospective sellers. They're a little red field. I go, you know what? I'm just going to open one up. So I opened one up. And it's a lady. So I picked up the phone in front of them, to their horror. I picked up the phone and I rang her. I said, oh, it's Charles calling from C21. I said, you had a market opinion 4 weeks ago. Do you mind if I ask you where you're up to with that? She said, well, actually, Charles, we wanted to list with Century 21, but we're going with another agent. And I said, why? Well, do you mind if I ask you why? She said, well, nobody called us back after they came out for the market opinion. And I said, look, I'm terribly sorry. Look, one of the agents in this office, one of the top agents in the country, and he's not the person that came to your property. Can I please send him out today? As you said, you wanted to list with us. Just give us the opportunity. She said, look, if he comes around 3 o'clock before the other agents come, no problem. He went out, listed, sold that property. That was a voice-to-voice contact that most agents just ignore. Mm. And I understand it, Sam. I understand why. I hated sometimes calling people because I felt like I hadn't spoken to them enough. So we came upon the old third party, which is how we started this conversation. And so I would say to Gary in my office, here's 10 of my leads. Give me 10 of yours. And I would call them up. And they go, hi, it's Charles calling from Combined Real Estate at that time. I go, oh, yes. Look, we haven't heard back from Gary. And I'd say sometimes, yes, I know Gary gets a bit lazy sometimes. He'd be in the next office cursing me. And I say, look, is there something I can help you with? And they go, yes, we still want to do. And it was amazing how much business we got, because for me, there was no rejection. I was calling somebody else's leads. So we say to people in the company all the time, third party, keep approaching it from a third party process. You won't get the blame for anything, and you're educating your buyers and sellers, and I think that's the best way to go. So still voice to voice, and I think a lot of agents just seem to ignore that very, very simple process without any rejection. That's fantastic.
In talking to some agents recently, it is super competitive out there at the moment because there's low stock levels everywhere. But I think agents let that psych them out a little bit in terms of they think it's so competitive so they won't bother calling back. Whereas in actual fact, if everyone's thinking like that, the person who actually does make the callback is the one that wins the listing.
Look, it's true. I can give you a series of examples that have occurred to me over the last 48 years. And one in particular really stands out for me. And I teach our salespeople in principle this. I got a call from an office to come and run an action meeting for them. That action meeting was about 6 hours away in a country town where the organization was located. And so I drove up in my fancy new car and the night before, and on the way up, I hit a wombat, which took a bit of damage out of the front of my car. It was still drivable, but it wasn't a very pretty looking car anymore. And the next morning, I get to the office and I rock in, and the principal there, lovely guy, feet up on the desk, R.M. William boots, and we're running a little action meeting, and we have a bit of fun with them. We get to the second part of our action meeting, which is going, and now this is all electronic, by the way, but in those days it was manual. Get to that second part where I ask for any unconditional transactions that have occurred in the last week. You know, so he goes and brings out three folders and puts them on the desk in those days. Again, lovely yellow manila folders. And I open up the first one and I said, let's give this person a call and we'll ask them prospecting question number one. And he looks at me and goes, I'm not giving her a call. She's a good friend of mine. And I was at her house on the weekend at a barbecue. So if she knew anybody, I said, listen, I went absolutely berserk. I won't do it for you now because some of your listeners might be offended. But I just went off my nut and then I went about my car and I hit a wombat and you asked me to come up here in 6 hours. If you ever seen a mad bloody leb jumping on a desk, a little short-ass leb like me. Anyway, eventually he's gone, all right, I'll give her a call. So he calls her up and he goes, g'day, love, but just giving you a call. I forgot to ask on the weekend, do you know of anybody who's buying, selling, renting? He was very nonchalant about it. It was not going to work. And 9 times out of 10, people do what we talked about earlier. You know, you walk into a shop, can I help you? No, thanks, I'm just looking. But with that, I jumped up, put my hand around his mouth, and she said no. And there was this silence for 3 or 4 seconds, and she's gone, are you still there? And I took my hand off his mouth, and she's gone, do you sell acreage? And there was just this starting process. If you give people time to think, to give you an example, how you get a yes out of a no, I'll ask you a question, Samantha. Would you be offended if I asked you a question, Samantha?
No.
That's a yes. And so I got a yes from you. I can ask you a question. And so most people will say no very quickly. And so she did. All of a sudden she had time to think. So he now takes his feet off the desk, he's leaning forward, his face is red, he's starting to write down this information. She's had more time to think. And actually some friends of mine have lost their job because of the closure of a local airline here and they're moving back to Sydney. Would you like me to put you in touch with them? So now he's got two people out of his so-called friend that would have told him on Saturday. He hangs up the phone, terribly red-faced. I mean, most agents, when they go, oh, do you know if anybody's thinking of buying, selling, or anything, people go, no, it's okay, thanks, I hang up. Hey, see, it doesn't work, mate. Anyway, he's red-faced, and I said, you'll need to call her back. He said, what are you talking about? I said, you didn't ask a prospecting question number two. I said, I'm not calling the back. You'll think I'm a dickhead. That's exactly what he said. I said, listen, mate, you want me to go over my bloody car and the wombat and you want me to get, you go, all right, I'll give her a call. So he calls her back and exactly what he said to her. He said, darling, you probably think I'm a dickhead, but what else is happening in your street? That famous question. And as true as I'm talking to you right now, Samantha, she said, I thought you knew the girl across the road who inherited the property 12 months ago is ready to sell. She's a good friend of mine. Let me put you in touch with her. He listed and sold 2 out of those 3 properties. It's a true story, and it's from a principal who was not even prepared to call somebody because he thought he'd be wasting his time. And I think that voice-to-voice with the right questions asked and that moments of silence can give you such an incredible result. And why not? You're the hero. When a property becomes unconditional or settled, you should be, as the agent, running a housewarming party for these people. You should be preparing the housewarming cards. You should be getting the balloons. You should be organizing a couple of $100 on Nibblies, because when you go to that housewarming party, who's the hero? Me. I go to house and they go, oh, you're Chaz. Oh, you know, blah, blah, blah. And if you go into South Penrith where I operated, there's a certain little type of pine tree that I used to plant as a gift for people near their mailbox. And I could take you past homes today that those pine trees have grown, and I knew I listed and sold those homes. And it's those little things that I think make a big, big, big difference. Small things make a big impact. And the agents today need to start remembering that we are in a business of communicating with people, and that they should maintain that communication, ask the right questions, take time to listen to what, give people time to think so that they can answer you effectively, and real estate becomes very easy from there.
Actually, you're right. Someone very wise told me about interviewing people on podcasts that you should shut up, and even if there's an uncomfortable silence, the gold is coming. I mean, look, you've got a lot of stories, and obviously you've seen quite a few cycles. You started your business, I think, just as we were coming out of the 80s recession. You combine real estate, that is, I'm talking about, like,
yeah,
way back
1977,
when.
Prior to that, the Whitlam government, which is very topical right now.
I know, right?
Was in government, and I lost my job in real estate before I bought my first business, because they put a credit squeeze on. And I reminded everybody in our daily podcast or our daily connect meetings across the network that in those days, for 3 months, you couldn't borrow money to buy a refrigerator. Unless you had cash, you couldn't buy anything. So that was for 90 solid days. We talk about tough. That's tough.
That's tough. My question was going to be, how does this COVID crisis and what's going on in various markets around the world compare to some of the other cycles that you've experienced?
Well, that cycle, as I mentioned, was very, very, very difficult, because even if you could communicate with people, unless they had cash, which is very rare, particularly in the area I worked in, which is very much a first home buyer area, unless you had cash, you couldn't buy anything. So it was shocking. There were people who wanted to sell, people desperate to sell, couldn't sell. Unlike today, where we can still communicate with people via the internet now, it's changed the world. We can still communicate. We can still present a property. There are still people buying property off plan. And so it's not as difficult, nowhere near as difficult. So I went through that process of, 18% interest rates. So think about that. I felt that really badly personally. If you had a home, if you had a $100,000 mortgage in those days, you were paying $18,000. The average salary was not even there. So those days are pretty tough. And even if people had to sell, most of the people couldn't afford to buy. So you go through cycles like that. Then you go through the GFC that we had, which was really, really very, very difficult for a lot of people. And this is a part I talk about a lot with people. You reach crossroads. I've reached lots of crossroads in my career. A lot of people, when they get to those crossroads, they exit left, or like Snagglepuss, or exit right, because they go, oh, yeah, look, maybe it's time to retire, or, oh, gee, this GFC has caused me to sell my business and get out, and I lost everything during the GFC, and they blame it. I say to people, look, as difficult as it is, when you reach a crossroads, what was your objective? And it's on the other side of those crossroads. It's not left or it's right. It's on the other side, and you need to push through. It's not easy, but you need to push through. And I think that's what a lot of people forget. They get to the crossroads and they give up, and then they use the crossroads as their excuse. I'm sorry to say that, but there are some people genuinely, when they get the crossroads, they retire and whatever else, and that's great. But there are a lot of people who use it as a reason not to push through to the other side. So it is difficult. COVID's difficult. It could even be more difficult if we're in the same position as US or countries like Great Britain or Brazil or those countries that have suffered very, very badly through this. I hope it doesn't get that way, because the Melbourne agents are doing fine because they learned a lot in the last lockdown. So many of them were prepared for this lockdown. They didn't know it was going to happen. Nobody did. They're getting through it. It's not easy, but they can still get through it. The thing I've noticed most about this situation, how we started the conversation, is that we have to deal one-on-one with people. That's different. And we have to demonstrate properties, particularly in Victoria now, possibly one-on-one. That's different. I think a lot of the education agents need right now is to go back to basics, learn how to demonstrate a property, learn how to close a sale, learn how to negotiate, because those are the sorts of things and skills they're going to need.
What do you see for Australia coming out of COVID the next 12 months? I mean, we've just come out of a very tricky 12 months. What do you see moving forward?
I'm sort of inspired in some way. The fact that, you know, people are still buying things on the internet. I've bought a few things and they've taken ages to get here now. So what I found is that domestically people are spending money here. And albeit we can't go to Rome or Paris or London or Venice or whatever, but everybody's holidaying here right now and all that money is being spent here. And people are careful about how they're spending their money and who they're spending it with. And I think that can be a great thing for Australia. So there are some things that have come out of this that may benefit our communities in the long term.
And what about your franchisees? So you bought Better Homes and Gardens Real Estate year before last. Time flies when you're having fun, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. Some people think that, oh, gee, isn't that conflicting with C21? Well, look, if I didn't buy it, somebody else was going to buy it and it would be in competition with me. I looked at it and it was offered to me because it's run by the same parent in the US, Realogy, that owns Century 21, ERA, Coldwell Banker, Sotheby's, etc. And I looked at it and thought, how can this benefit C21? Firstly, it pitches differently. I feel that Better Homes has a more style, homely feel to it, and it would attract a certain type of agent to it. So I thought it pitches differently. Secondly, a C21 franchisee with no upfront cost can take a Better Homes and Gardens franchise and open it down the road if they wish, if they feel. And I can tell you a few of them have done that because they feel that the brand will pitch differently for them to what C21 has been for them. The other reason that I bought it was that there are a lot of real estate agents that work in our offices that may want to open a business of their own, and the principal may not want to give up equity. So the principal can open the office down the road and give salespeople equity so they don't lose those people. And I see that happen a lot. A lot of people that come and talk to us about franchising are salespeople who are not getting offered any equity from their principal. They end up opening in competition to their principal. So this gives our principals an opportunity to make sure that they keep their good people. And the one thing that came out of it that I didn't recognize at first was the relationship with Channel 7 at the time and how they introduced us to the magazine. And then they offered to me Home Beautiful magazine, which is the number one magazine for homes in Australia. I wouldn't have been offered that if I hadn't have bought Better Homes, because they owned the Better Homes and Gardens magazine as well. And so now the C21 offices, if you go to Home Beautiful site, which has over 1,040,000, when I looked at it last time, followers, if you go to that site, one missing link they had was property. They have decorations, they have food, they have travel, but they didn't have real estate. So if you go to their site now, there's a section called Open Homes. And when you click on it, guess where it goes? Call for a market opinion, it goes back to C21. All properties we have advertised on our website are on the Home Beautiful website. No other real estate company can say they have anything that closely resembles that at all. So we now have C21 aligned with the most successful home magazine in Australia, and we are the only agents on their website. So go figure. All those things open up when you take a step. Every time you take a step, you see more and more opportunities present themselves. Some of the other agents have said to me, oh, that's a bit silly what you're doing. But realistically, they are very different brands. They pitch very differently to the consumer. Tell me what real estate company out there resembles anything close to what Better Homes and Gardens Real Estate does to people who watch it today as kids with their great-grandparents who watch it every week, watch the show every week. That is the brand. How can you not say that it pitches a certain way, and how can you not say that it's a great idea to take that to the marketplace? We started opening offices just before COVID, so we had to slow down a bit. It's now kicked on again, which is great. But I'm very pleased to say that just the other day we opened a Better Homes and Gardens in Gympie, and the owner of that is Century 21 in Gympie. And he's put a couple of lovely ladies in there, professional ladies. They've decorated it up, and it's got all the grass and the things you expect from Better Homes and Gardens. The Better Homes and Gardens magazine is available for them to advertise in, just as Home Beautiful magazine is available exclusively for Century 21 agents to advertise in it. And he's now getting listings that he wasn't getting at a level that his C21 office wasn't pitching themselves, you see. And so I think that's the key to it. And to me, it's a great opportunity to create diversity in real estate. it proves, Sam, once and for all, that I haven't been in this real estate business 50 years, 1 year, 50 times, because I have made some progress.
Well, actually, I was going to ask you about that, because I think you actually started in real estate as a property manager.
I did. I think I wasn't called an SK, you know, which that means. I was below an SK. I started cleaning flats in Andy Palumbo Real Estate in Marrickville because my sister was a property manager and she got me a job there while I waited for my HSC results back in 72. And I'd come out of boarding school and I'd moved to the Big Smoke because I'm from Crookwell, a small country town northwest of Goulburn, where my good dear friend John Simon, Aussie Home Loans, was born. There you go. So I got a job cleaning flats and the property manager went on a holiday. She said, put on a shirt and tie. I did, and that was it.
And off you go. Not only does that shows massive progress in 50 years. Are we having a party for your 50 years? Is that what's happening?
I don't know. People are hoping I'll bugger off. And I keep telling them, unless the proverbial bus hits me, I'm not going anywhere. I don't ever want to pull back. I certainly want to hold a position in real estate and I'd love to grow my businesses. And there's some really quality people work in my organization that are growing and coming up through the ranks. I'm grooming a couple of those people for leadership positions now and so that I can still participate in the organization. As you know, I don't have any partners or shareholders in my business. So it's a bit odd because my children are not interested. I told them to do what they want to do, and my daughter's a naturopath nutritionist, and my son is in the entertainment business, currently studying a degree at the Australian Institute of Music. They are so far away from real estate. So I've got nobody, you know, and it's strange, but at the same time, it's lovely knowing that we've got a business and we're growing some individuals from within it who are already outstanding and will be very outstanding future leaders in real estate.
So two more questions. One is, we've had a lot of advice for salespeople throughout this COVID period that actually I think works in any sort of weather. But given your background in property management and having bought and sold some massive rent rolls over your career, and I think we need another podcast, Charles, but
okay.
Do you have any advice for property managers in this crazy time?
Yeah, I mean, it still comes back. Look, property management to me is still a sales business. A lot of property managers may not want to hear that. They don't like to see themselves as salespeople, but they still need to sell themselves and keep people engaged. That's the hard part. That's the big part. When you're a property manager and you might be managing 100 properties or plus, you've got to keep in touch with those people. They need to know they're sitting out there. They don't care about the fact that you manage 100 properties. And this is what we say to salespeople. They don't care that you're busy with 10 opens. They only care about their home. And one of the best pieces of advice I give to property managers is not to talk about how difficult it is or how many people they've got to talk to or how many issues they've had or the vacancy rate or so on. Just talk to that person as though they are the only person you have as a client. They don't want to hear anything else. And I think if you do that, you'll not only rescue them, and you'll not only, we always say if you build a relationship, the conditions become negotiable. So if you build that relationship with those people, any of the conditions around their property, you're able to negotiate a satisfactory result for them and the tenant. And it's the same with the tenant. Tenants are not third-class citizens. The majority of tenants actually are future buyers, and some of those tenants already own properties, but they're being transferred into those areas, and they probably know more about real estate than most people do. So it's important that the communication with those people and the relationship with those people is critical, and that you remain neutral and keep away from the facts. You don't need to tell an individual all of the problems and issues that you have. They only want to know about their issue.
And one last question, if there was one thing that you would like everyone to remember from this awesome chat that you and I have had this morning, what would it be?
For me, it's a wonderful thing to talk about vision and its goals and objectives. If I would like to share something with anybody who listens to this podcast, is exactly that. I'm not a goal setter, which is a bit strange. because a lot of people talk about goals. I set objectives, short-term objectives, because I know in my industry that you've got to keep people engaged, and salespeople leave very quickly if they don't get results. So short-term objectives, long-term dreams is the key for me. If I can sit down every day, which I try to do most days, and envision what my businesses look like, I can't remember where I read it, but picture in your mind the able, earnest person you desire to be, and the thought that you hold is hourly transforming you into that particular individual. In that thought is supreme to preserve the right mental attitude, the attitude of faith, courage, good cheer, and those things are attracted to you. Sometimes it doesn't look like that, but that's what happens. So short-term objectives, I wake up each morning with a diary that I've written up the night before or a calendar I prepared, so I have purpose. I know exactly what I want to do today. Og Mandino put in his book, The Greatest Salesman in the World, "I will build my castle one brick at a time, for I know that small attempts repeated will complete any undertaking." So as those short-term objectives and that long-term vision. And I'll finish by saying that I was with my son in a car park picking up a chair at Office Works. It was his car, and it was for his little study desk at the time. And we came out of Office Works in Penrith, and it was hot. And I could feel the heat. I could smell Penrith, and I don't mean in a bad way, just the whole feeling of Penrith. And I had a goal when I was a kid. I used to be a goal setter, and I had a goal, and I was looking through one of my old diaries, which I've still got here in my little study from 1978, and I was going through them to see if I could extract any ideas, concepts, stories, situations. And I found this drawing that I had, and it was a drawing of a shop in High Street, Penrith, which is still there, with three little shop fronts. And I thought, I'm going to buy that shop. I'm going to buy that building. I'm going to put commercial here. I'm going to put residential rentals here. I'm going to put sales here. And this was my goal, right? And I said to my son, sometimes in life it's wonderful when you don't reach your goals. And at that time I hadn't spoken to him about vision. He said, what do you mean? I said, it's important sometimes, Joseph. He said, but Dad, coming from you, that's really strange. You always talk about goals. I said, Joseph, if I'd have achieved that goal of opening this shop in Penrith and having the biggest real estate agency in Penrith, I'd probably still be there. You see, the thing is that goals are restrictive. And sometimes when you set goals, you don't realize that you could do so much more, that you have so much more potential to do so many more things for other people and create an environment that is conducive to that saying, that which you share will multiply, that which you withhold will diminish. And he got it. He understood it. And I think if I can leave your listeners with that, it's short-term objectives, long-term dreams. Don't set a goal that restricts you from who you could possibly be.
Yeah, amazing. Charles Tarby, thank you so much.
Thank you, Samantha.
Will you play us out?
Yeah, man.
You enjoyed this episode of Elevate, with thanks to connectnow.com.au. Don't forget to download your written action guide from this podcast containing extra tips, links, and shortcuts. Visit eliteagentelevate.com.